from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 360, recorded live Thursday, February 28th, 2013. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at telerik.com. And by franklins.net, training developers to work smarter, and now offering GesturePack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Llewellyn Falco about his approval tests open source project.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here at Agile Open Northwest in Portland, Oregon. Just came out from a lovely lunch and all sorts of Agile luminaries and really cool people in there. But now I'm sitting here with you, Llewellyn Falco. How are you, sir?
Doing great. Good to be here.
Now, you've got a project called Approval Tests.
Yes.
People can go out and Google for it and find it. It's up on GitHub, and you've got lots of videos, and you've actually got a little courseware series about approval tests on YouTube. Why should I care about approval tests?
Well, why should you care about approval tests, or why should you care about testing at all?
Well, that's a good question. Let's start with your project, and we'll get into why I should care about testing at all.
So if you care about testing, you'll run up against things that are harder to test. And that, I mean, I find personally that when I have something that's harder to do, I tend to do it less. And so there's that sort of natural feed. And approval tests will make things easier for you to test. And that means you will do it more. And, you know, I think sort of a tenet of programming is let's be lazy.
Yeah, exactly. So, the best programmers are the laziest.
Exactly.
So I know that just setting up unit tests can be frustrating. And there's XUnit and NUnit and MS test and lots of different things to choose from. But then there's also integration tests. And people are always asking about like Selenium for browser testing or different testing things that you should do, WinForms. Then there's things like BDD, yep, behavior-driven testing, and there's SpecFlow and Cucumber. Even deciding on a test framework can itself be a little bit difficult and confusing.
A lot to choose from, really. And, yeah, and I think in the .NET world, we have more choices than many other places. So it just adds more to the to that upfront decision.
So if I buy into approval test, which is your framework, is that something that is going to work with an existing framework I have, or am I going to layer your stuff on top of an existing?
You're
going to
layer it underneath. Yeah.
Underneath.
Yeah. So I have a very big, I hate making that choice myself. Mm-hmm. And there's all these great tools that are already out there supporting all these other frameworks. And so I, you know, in the spirit of being lazy, I wanted to keep using all those things for me. And so we are just a DL that sits underneath that, mm-hmm, gives you a more powerful way of doing an assert.
Okay, interesting. So rather than wrapping existing things or sitting on top of or buying into, which I think some other frameworks that are different.
Yeah, most frameworks work that way.
Right. Like some of the BDD things, it's like, you know, thou shalt test this way. So I'm going to test the same way I tested before, but then when things get complicated for an assert, like for example, if I wanted to assert the output of, well, assert an array.
Yes.
Let's say I've got an array of 100 things and I want to say, did this look exactly as I expected it?
And that's something that asserts were never meant to do well. And part of the skill of unit testing was, A, figuring out how do I test that array. But actually, you'll see if you sit with a lot of the people who do unit testing a lot, their skill was figuring out how do I write a test that doesn't need 100 things, but will give me the results. And that takes a lot of effort. And what I found is once I was able to, you know, verify a 100-array array, I had to do a lot less work to just write a regular unit test. And I could write unit tests that were closer to what my customers were thinking, closer to what I was thinking.
Interesting. So I'm hearing you say that a purist of unit testing might not appreciate some of the things that we're trying to test. Like, you're trying to test that 100 things are exactly as they should be in an array. What are you doing? You're doing it wrong.
Well,
and you're making it easy for me to do it that way.
Exactly. I think any time that you spend effort to get good at something, you feel like that effort should be there. And I see that in programmers all the time, especially around stuff like VI and stuff where it's like, I have learned to do this. What do you mean you're using these shortcuts, or what are you using this visual editor for? Like, they forget that just because they put effort in it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's say I like XUnit. Can I use XUnit with approval tests?
Absolutely.
So you call them assertions, but the different unit testing frameworks may not call them that, but the essence is the same.
The essence is usually the same, and usually it maps one to one. Whether you use the word assert or should be or whatever language it is, I have a primitive, usually on one side, matching a primitive on the other side. Mm-hmm. An approval test takes a very fundamentally different approach to this. It says, produce your object. I'm going to show it to you. And once you say it's okay, as long as you continue to produce it, I'm going to pass. And if you fail, I'm then going to show you what you used to have and what you have now. And I'm going to give you different tools. And one of the things approval test does is it opens up other programs to help you do that. So if you do have that long string of, an array of 100, we will open it up in a text editor mm-hmm. or a diff program of your choice, right? There's lots of different options because everyone has their favorite diff tool. Mm-hmm. But the diff tool then gives you extra information. So you don't just see, here's 100 lines of text, here's 100 lines of text, what's different? It will start highlighting on line 99, we're missing this line. And that can help you see, the line is missing, another line got added, or the line got changed. All different things that mm-hmm. you don't normally get from an assert.
So you're saying that that's concerning to me. I think of unit tests as something that are very not interactive. Is this something that I see while I'm developing the test or while a test is running on a headless server somewhere?
So there's two stages. It's interactive until you get it working. Once you get it working, it's then non-interactive.
I see.
Until it fails. Right. So you can run on a headless server and just fail.
Right.
But when you go back and you say, why is this failing? Then it's going to interact with you and say, hey, this is why it's failing.
Okay, so how do I tell the system that it is headless and shouldn't be popping dialog boxes with tortoise diff?
So we use attributes called reporters, and you can configure those sort of at multiple levels. You can configure them at the method level, use this reporter. You can configure them at the class level, use this reporter, and you can configure them at the assembly level. And it uses the method of least surprise. So if it's a method, it's going to show up there. It's going to override the class. If it's on the class, it's going to override what's at the assembly level. But there is also a in front of thing. So it can detect I'm on a build server or I'm on a headless mm-hmm. system, and it won't do it.
And does it do that with a config switch somewhere? Or how do you know that I'm on a build server?
Approval test knows based on some of just the build servers, right? So right now that we use TeamCity a lot. And it will detect that TeamCity is running it. Mm-hmm. Conversely, we use InCrunch a lot, which InCrunch will run every second as you do keystrokes. You don't want stuff popping up all the time. So it will detect if InCrunch is running it versus if you're running it through MS Test in Visual Studio.
If I did it interactively.
Exactly. And it will sort of default to not be interactive if it doesn't need to. In general, approval test uses convention over configuration, mm-hmm. right? But you can always go to configuration. You can always hard put in if I haven't thought about your situation or you're doing something unique.
So some testing frameworks say assert and other ones say expect. Yours uses this verb verify a lot.
Yeah.
And that seems as generic a verb as one could imagine. I mean, that just seems super generic, like verify, which is like do it.
Exactly. And that's why we actually started with approve, which turned out to be the wrong verb. But I'm a big believer that you will write better code on multiple levels if you write your intention in English first, that the brain you have that works in English, that knows how to tell stories, that knows how to write paragraphs or choose words is multiple times, order of magnitudes more developed than our brain that can think in C# or VB, like we just have so much more value there. So if you start in English and then you keep pulling to code, you'll get cleaner code, more modular code, just overall better code. And what I found I was doing is I kept saying like, well, I'm making a triangle with links 3, 4, 5, and now I need to verify that the perimeter is right. And then I would translate it to some other word, like approve. And I was like, why does verify... I'm saying in English, I want to verify the perimeter. Why aren't I just saying in my code, verify T.perimeter? Mm-hmm. And so that's why that word came out.
So verify, in my mind, just kind of means make sure it's okay.
Exactly.
Okay. So if I've got a method that does, does some stuff, and then the output of that is an array of 100 somethings.
Yep.
I think what I would probably do in a regular unit testing scenario is assert a bunch of things. Maybe I would assert the first five and get lazy and not do the rest. How would I do that with approval test to assert that this array of 100 names is sorted correctly?
Exactly. So let's say that you're doing like a word count. You put in a block of text. It's going to create out a dictionary. You would just say approvals.verifyAll and then give it the dictionary, and that would be it. And what approvals will do is it'll actually sort the dictionary keys so it's consistent, right? Because there's no order.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no order for the way the keys will come out.
Right.
And then it will print them out as a file, and you'll see this key has this value. And you'll see them all. You'll look at them. You get to harness a whole bunch of recognition over intent, which is really nice, right? I might not realize exactly that this word was supposed to have five, but when I scroll through, I can recognize that, oh yeah, that's the way it was. And then you just rename the file from received to approved. Mm-hmm. And in a diff tool, that rename is just hit the right and say, use on the left side.
Okay, so let me think about this. If I've got a class called person test, and I've got a method called sorting, and I work, you know, verify sorting or something like that, you're going to make a file called personTest.verifySorting.approved, or received, rather.
We'll make the receive file, and then as soon as you see what you like, you're going to rename it to approved.
Okay.
And after that, as long as they match, test will pass.
So you'll take my data structure, and you're a serializer, right? You're not doing a two-string on it, because otherwise I'd see system.dictionary prime whatever.
So by default, we'll do a two-string. Mm-hmm. But yes, we do a lot of convenient serializing, because a lot of the default two-strings in the .NET framework mm-hmm. are not very useful.
Now, you're going to serialize it in your own format. You're going to serialize it in a format that makes sense for someone who's trying to do an approval test.
Exactly.
What if I'm, you know, hardcore JSON, or I really just love JSON, or I really love XML? Can I make my own serializer and approve that?
Absolutely. Approval test in general is very modular, so you can fit whatever you want. Serialization you can actually put as a step in front mm-hmm. of calling approval tests, so that you can make just a convenience file that says verify my JSON and pass in your object and format it correctly. XML, we already have. You can put it in and it will format that for you using the default XML formatters that okay. come with .NET.
So then in the future, if I've got 500 approval tests, am I going to have 500 reflection created, you know, class dot method name dot approved dot text files in
Absolutely. And you need to check the approved files into your source control.
Okay.
And it creates a couple very interesting scenarios. One is, while we don't have customers that actually look at the code, we will have customers that say, oh, I need this XML to change. And they will just go and actually change the approval file mm-hmm. and literally like put a story into our backlog directly. Mm-hmm. We're like, oh, it's failing. Here, I need to fix this. They can also do that with drawing on. We can serialize strings, but we can serialize images or sound files or anything really. And so.
Yeah, let's put a pin on that, because I want to talk about that, because that's a really interesting thing. We'll talk about serializing non-textual based things in just a moment. So if I have 500 of these, and they're now source, they are artifacts, source yes. artifacts. I might have a business person on the team who doesn't know code, but he can open a text file. You're saying he's going to go poking around in there now, if he wants to, potentially.
If he wants to. And I mean, so this is a limited case, right? But yeah, if they are saying.
Or is it?
So, if the closer the test is to an acceptance test where you're speaking in the language of the user, mm-hmm. the more chances of that happening. Mm. But we allow you to verify anything. And just because you can speak at the big level doesn't mean you always should. I want to be clear. I think you should speak at the customer level a lot. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times as you go in, you need to speak more in a programmer voice.
If I had an existing system with, you know, XUnit or NUnit or MS test for my low-level unit testing, I've got an existing integration testing framework. I've got maybe spec flow or something like that where I'm doing my specification testing. Am I pretty much done, or do I still need approval tests to fill a gap that I may not realize I have?
Approval tests is a place that can aid all of those.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're doing your unit test in XUnit and you have a dictionary that you want to verify,
mm-hmm.
this will help you to do that. If you're doing an integration test and you have a web page that you want to verify, this can help you do that. it's not what level you're at. It's at any level where just a simple integer or string is no longer sufficient to do the verification.
Okay. Playing devil's advocate then, how is this not just diffing text files?
So to some extent, it is just diffing text files. You could write, you know, a poor man's approval test that just says, here's how I figure out the file name, and here's how I write the file, and here's how I diff it. Mm-hmm. And that's really all we're doing. We are just wrapping that around. When you say approvals.verify, the first thing it does is it says, what's the file name that I'm going to need, and where is that location going to be? Mm-hmm. And then it says, how do I serialize this information to that file? And then it says, let me compare it. And then finally it says, if it doesn't compare, let me launch something to help you. Mm-hmm. That's really all it's doing. It is just comparing files. It's just taking the redundancy and the duplication of that away from you.
Okay. And then it sounds like adding a series of opportunities to plug in things like serializers, to plug in strategies. If I don't like my 500 text files sitting in the root of my directory, I suppose I could tell you to put them somewhere else?
Absolutely. And in fact, when we do stuff like with Node and other languages, we'll put them into databases where we might not have access to a file system.
So this means this isn't just for .NET.
No, I am a large believer in pair programming. And so we have this in Java. We have it in Ruby. We have it in PHP. We have it in Perl. We have it in Node. And we have it in .NET.
Well, now you're just showing off.
I am.
Okay, well, that answers the question of how is this not just doing text files. This is where a utility function to compare text files, which someone could dismiss this as, has now become a framework and a style for conventions and a style of developing tests.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a tool to help you. I still use asserts, and there are still times when just a simple verification of a number or a Boolean is appropriate. But there's a lot of places where I want to verify something richer.
Then that is another important point, because you're telling me that approval test doesn't take over my tests. It doesn't demand that I do things a certain way if I've got asserts that work.
Oh, yeah, you can put them right alongside.
Okay. Can I only verify one thing per test? Because I saw that there's a file that's created. What if I want to verify multiple things? Is that a limitation of approval tests, or am I testing wrong?
So you can verify more than one thing. By default, you only can verify one thing because it will take the name of your test. Mm-hmm. There is a name refactory, so you can do things like put steps in if you need to, or if you have something that's very machine specific, right? Or operating system, it's going to verify one way on Windows 7 and another way on Windows 8.
Or one way under Mono and one way under .NET.
That would be
a really useful thing.
And so we do have that facility. Most of the time, though, it's one approval per unit test. Mm-hmm. And while an approval is definitely richer than an assert, it does uphold to the idea of verifying one thing for mm-hmm. your test.
Okay. Which is the point of testing.
Yes. It's a good principle to hold to.
Okay. These reporters, though, that you talked about, these attributes can be added on. By default, we are diffing text files. But then you said something about diffing sound files and graphics. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So I do a lot of work in .NET, and I'm a huge fan of C#. And that means working with a lot of Microsoft technologies. And that can sometimes be difficult to test because they weren't always invented with testing in mind. And so as I have moved across and gone to different technologies, I've been able to find patterns of how to test them. And the nice thing about approval tests is you can encode that pattern into mm-hmm. just an API call. And so if I'm testing a WIN form, then I just want to pull that up and I want to see the form. And so I just say approval or WIN form approvals.verify, and I pass it the WIN form. It will take a screen capture of that. And now I don't want to see it in a text diff, but I will want to see it in an image diff. And so it knows that this is an image and it will use a different set mm-hmm. on its reporters, and it will open something like Tortajima's diff or Beyond Compare and show me those images and let me compare them that way. And that's really helpful. And you can do that with WPF, and you can do that with WIN forms. You can do it with RDLC reports, which is a very hard thing to test otherwise.
RDLC?
So if you want to do reporting inside your WIN forms, mm-hmm. there's a reporting package from Microsoft called RDLC reports, and this will test them with no problem. You just give it there and make a really fake data set. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's even utilities in it to make a fake data set.
Totally brainstorming. Random tangent. What if I'm doing D3 JavaScript charting? in a browser, and I want to verify that. I know I can do Selenium, and I can verify the DOM, but what if I want to verify that it looks right?
Exactly.
Can I take a screenshot of that somehow with this tool?
So by default, what it will actually do is it will capture the HTML, not rendered as a screenshot. And it will take that HTML, and then it will launch it to you in a browser, which will render it for you. You'll see it. You'll be like, hey, that's nice, and you'll verify the HTML. The next time it runs, it won't render at all. But if the HTML ever changes, it will launch it in the browsers, and you can see what changes. Mm-hmm. It is actually possible to capture it as a screenshot, but that's a lot of work and usually not necessary. So we try to go to what's as far as you need to go to make it practical.
Okay. So if I were generating dynamically a PNG of a pie chart, that might be an appropriate thing.
Absolutely appropriate.
Okay. But in an example of a DOM manipulation, that's where you're getting really close to customer acceptance testing, and you can't automate all of that.
Yeah, and the manipulation of the DOM is the doing of the test. Hmm. Approval test really doesn't give you much for the doing. It gives you for the verification.
I see.
After, like in the JavaScript side, after you manipulate the DOM, now if you want to say, what does my DOM look like? Mm-hmm. You can do that. And you can do that through Selenium as well. Just say, verify the DOM, and it will print out the DOM structure for mm-hmm. you.
Now, you said reporters. I think I was looking at the code, and I saw something called a clipboard reporter.
Yes.
What is that?
So every different tool has some different way of slightly modifying things, it seems, when they want to. They'll either trim off the last tailing space, or they'll switch out your returns, or they just do stuff. And so every once in a while, you'll get to a place where it's, even though you move it over, it's actually not making an exact copy. So there's always the thing of just going to the command line and typing in manually, you know, move this file over to this file. But then you have to remember how to do that on the command line. The clipboard reporter generates that command and puts it on your clipboard. So if you use a clipboard reporter, you can just drop to your command line and paste, and it will approve the file for you that way. And it will do it. You can do it in combinations of other reporters as well. But you don't always want to mess up your clipboard, so we don't do it unless you ask for it.
And these reporters are then presented as attributes that I then decorate on my test class.
Exactly.
What are some other reporters that I might make? Or what are some interesting third-party kind of reporters you've seen in the wild?
So the diff reporter is a really common one, and that's actually, it uses change of responsibility. So it will go and say, do I have a reporter? Code compare, I think, is the first one. Oh, you don't have that? Okay, well, do you have beyond compare? Oh, you don't have that? Well, do you have tortoise diff? Oh, you don't have that? Do you have when diff? And it will keep going until it finds the first one you have, and it'll bring it up there. There's one for the web config, or the app config file, where you can configure in your app config. So if you want to have different reporters by default than a teammate has, mm-hmm. There's lots of combination reporters where you can say, use this reporter and this reporter. So open a web browser and open a diff tool. The file launch reporters are really interesting. When people start going into different tools, right? So when something fails, you want to understand why it failed. And the richer your object is, maybe the more you need to understand that. Mm-hmm. And so people always sort of say, oh, I wish I had it opened here, right? And so if you wanted that opened in a tool, you just extend a very simple interface and say, I'm going to pass you the receive file and the approve file, and you do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. Launch whatever program you want. That's what people usually do to say, I want this tool that I had not thought of.
You know, one thing that you're getting me thinking about that I hadn't thought about before is I'm hearing you say that there are a number of times when your tool will open up the thing that I'm going to need, or another way of phrasing it would be the thing I was going to open anyway.
Exactly.
And part of like my unit testing lizard brain is like, that's not what unit tests are supposed to do. You're not supposed to be launching stuff. I keep going back to like headless. This thing needs to run on the build server. But at the same time, when I'm writing the test and I'm in Visual Studio and I'm goofing around, there's this unconscious action where it's like, oh, the test failed. Alt-tab over to the console. Type in notepad. Da-da-da-da-da. Dig around in the XML file. You're saying that your testing framework recognizes that there is a time when you are getting ready to write tests and you're actively debugging tests, and you're saving me those tedious lizard brain actions.
And there are different personalities that you put on. When something has never worked, I want different information from my tests than when it is working, and I want different information yet again when it used to be working and then it stopped. These are different
That just blew my mind. Like, there's different information. When it's never actually worked, that's when I spend the most time slapping the keyboard, opening diff tools, copy-pasting stuff into paint.net, you know, all those kind of things. And you're saying, exactly. if paint.net's what I need to open, then I write a little interface and it launches paint.net, and I can remove that later when I switch over into nCrunch or whatever is going to be doing that work for me.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I love writing tests is because they help me get my idea quicker into the world. And it's that sort of example that's really servicing me. And in fact, when I am writing my own tests, the example services me to focus my ideas on what it is I want to write and help me actually write it. And so an example is really useful. And a lot of times when I sit down with people who are interested in testing but haven't gotten to testing yet, I find that they're going directly to the code and trying to write a test, and they've actually skipped that step. So if you have people out there who are listening who are like, oh, I've always thought about testing, maybe this is the place to start, I would suggest write an example on paper. Get away from the keyboard. Write it on paper. This is what I want my example to do. And then see if you can write that as a unit test. And maybe you can, maybe you can't. But if you keep doing that, you'll find more and more often that you can. And that's where you really sort of walk your way into testing.
My biggest struggle with testing is probably the way I'm writing my code, where it's just too tied up into reality. Well, yes. I feel tests are very abstract. And then if I struggle and go off and try to write these tests, I end up writing tests that don't really do anything. They just kind of move bits around, but nothing really gets tested. Like, for example, I'm writing this Windows Phone app right now. It goes out to a data feed and it gets the data feed. It parses the data feed and then it gets an MP3 and then it plays the MP3. So unless it's running in the phone, actually going to the internet, actually playing the thing, all I can really write a test around is the parsing.
Yeah. And that's always a struggle with testing, is figuring out what do I want to test and what do I not want to test. One of the things that guides me is the saying, test until bored. Right. So this is something you're going to do anyways, because once you get bored, you'll just stop doing it and then you'll no longer be bored. But find the pieces that give you good return on investment and test those, and the pieces that aren't, let them go. And if you turned out you were wrong, you're going to get an iteration when your customers complain about bugs, and then maybe you'll be a little less bored. And so let that be your guide. You don't have to test everything. And if you try to test everything, you'll fail because there's just too many things. Test until bored. When you're bored, stop.
I love that. Test until bored. So, Llewellyn Falco, where can people go online to find approval tests and learn more about it?
So to add it to your project, just go to NuGet. And that's a phenomenal thing that has occurred in the last 2 years in the .NET world, is NuGet has really made it just so much easier to find and use tools. So go to NuGet and just type in approval tests, all one word. If you want to learn more about it, I suggest go to approvaltest.com, watch the videos. You can find them on YouTube as well. You can also find them. We've recently moved everything over to GitHub. And so if you go to GitHub and look for approvals too. So GitHub/approvals is the foundation.
And all the languages are there.
All the languages are in GitHub, except for Java. Java's still in the process of being moved over.
Very cool. Well, I appreciate you chatting with me today.
It's been great to be here.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.